we have, for the most, lost the ability to make things for ourselves, and so we buy them from China. Flush with our cash, China can now afford to buy the foods that have made us all tall and strong. This leads us to ask, how will China's 1.3 billion person appetite affect our food chain?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 593rd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford is out there working the phones right now. And also, Parmley Taff and Kelsey Olson are missing in action today, but that's okay. It's summer. Folks, a confession. I am a Sinophile. I do have an inordinate interest in China that has, during some parts of my life, bordered on the obsessive. I studied the Chinese language for 3 years. I have a degree in Chinese literature from the University of California. And once, I even had the time of my life in the Chinese port city of Hong Kong. Long ago, I came to believe that China truly is the Middle Kingdom, and in the course of my studies, always wondered what would happen were this culture of 1.3 billion people to break out of its shell and turn itself loose on the world. Well, China has broken out of its shell, and it has turned itself loose on the world of we foreign devils. As a consequence, China is now the world's largest creditor nation with over $1 trillion of our cold, hard cash in its stash. And we have become the world's greatest debtor nation. And every day, we borrow more money from China so that we could buy more things Chinese. So today we pause to ask, how will China's 1.3 billion person appetite affect our food chain? And here to help us out, we have Harwood Schaffer, who is research associate, the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. Harwood, welcome to the Food Chain.
Glad to be here, Michael.
A little bit about Harwood here. You're an interesting person. You are an ordained pastor.
Yes.
You're a PhD candidate in sociology.
Yes.
You're a research associate with the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee.
Right.
What is that?
It's a research level at the university at the master's. Basically, most of the people in it are master's people that have master's degrees and do a lot of the detailed research under the direction of faculty members.
Mm-hmm. And you just returned from China.
Yes, we did.
And what did you see?
It was absolutely amazing. We saw an agriculture that was different and more vibrant than we ever expected.
In what did you expect to see? Let's start there.
The line that we often get is that the average farmer in China has maybe an acre and a quarter, about 6/10 mm-hmm. of a hectare in ground. And so the image that comes up in my mind based on American farming patterns is that the land is divided up into lots of very small plots, and each plot has a house on it and a lane and then some farm ground around it, and is separated by some kind of fence or something from the neighbor who then has a similar plot.
And the reality was?
And the reality was that farmers live in villages. And the fields are huge. And abundant.
Did you ever happen to run across a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries?
No.
By F.H. King. F.H. King was the Secretary of Agriculture back at the turn of the last century, 1900 or so, somewhere in there. And he went to China to perhaps, you know, teach the Chinese about some modern ways of doing things. And his comments were pretty much just exactly like yours. Holy smokes, these people are very efficient at what they do. Would that be a fair assessment of what you saw?
That would be a fair assessment. To give you a quick overview, we'd been in Beijing for a couple of days and met with academics, and then we got on a high-speed train to head out to a town nearby, the Yucheng Experiment Station in Yucheng, China, which is about 4 hours south of Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting in the train looking out the window, and we're amazed by the things that we see. The first thing is that we see these large fields, and they...
Would these be the grain fields?
They were mostly grain, large wheat fields. I mean, the wheat was ready for harvest because this was just a week ago. Mm-hmm. Or 2 weeks ago, and they were just getting ready for their winter wheat harvest in the North China Plain, and we saw fields with grain that were next to each other. We didn't see, you know, the divisions that we expected, but we saw some things that we didn't expect, other things we didn't expect. For instance, close to the railroad, as the railroad had gone through, obviously, to get the banking for the railroad, they had dug up earth to build the roadbed and left behind depressions that were then converted into fish ponds.
Right.
And we would see fish ponds adjacent to each other with a dike separating them. And on the top of the dike were drilled four rows of wheat.
Wow.
On top of the dike between the fish ponds. I mean, every square inch that was available for production was under production. American farmers certainly would not have planted wheat, just four rows of wheat on top of a dike.
But that was four rows of more wheat than they would have had otherwise.
That's right.
And, you know, that's kind of the impression that I had as a young man fresh out of Montana. My grandfather had a 320 irrigated acre farm. And as a young man running around Japan, for example, I would ride my bicycle out into the countryside just be amazed at the productivity and the efficiency and the utilization of resources of the Asian farmers. Were just somehow they figured out how to take my grandfather's 320 acres and just kind of compress it down into a few, because nothing was wasted anywhere.
Certainly was the same in the North China Plain, and we went up to the northeast to Harbin. We saw the same pattern. We also saw things that I've never seen in the United States. We saw wheat fields, and you'd run seven or eight rows of double rows of wheat, and then you'd run a row of poplar trees, and then another seven or eight rows of wheat, and another row of poplar trees. And the poplar trees were planted in a rotation. And then every 8 or 10 years, they harvested the poplar trees.
For firewood.
So you had winter wheat growing in among poplar trees.
Wow.
Some of them, the saplings obviously didn't affect the yield much. The larger ones certainly must have affected mm-hmm. it some. Although a good bit of the winter wheat growing season is during the time when poplars don't have any leaves on them.
Right. And doesn't this introduce something new to the Western imagination in that this kind of agriculture surely is a people-intensive agriculture, where we have learned here in the West to supplant expensive human labor with less expensive money inputs, for example, machinery, chemicals, and so on.
And fossil fuel.
So what you see in China is still very much an agriculture based on human productivity, correct?
Extremely so. I mean, the intensity of cultivation and the hand labor that's put in is everywhere. It's much more intensive and much less fossil fuel and machine dependent than U.S. agriculture.
Folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have Harwood Schaffer, who is a research associate with the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee, just returned from China, and China is the subject of our conversation today. What impact will China's 1.3 billion person appetite have on our ability to eat food? What do you think? Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about China, specifically. What will China's 1.3 billion person appetite, what kind of impact will that appetite have on our food chain here in the United States? We have Harwood Schaffer with us, who is the research associate at the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee, just returned from China. Harwood, we're wondering, is China's agriculture able to support its population of 1.3 billion people?
For the most part, it is true. They've been able to increase their grain production so that they are a small net grain exporter, not an importer.
Right.
We've been expecting them since the mid-90s to quickly become a grain importer.
Didn't happen.
Of huge quantities, and despite the projections that have been made by USDA year after year that the importing is going to start in 2 years, it hasn't. And so they're still a small grain net exporter, but are able to meet all of their grain needs. There are two major agricultural inputs that are agricultural products that China imports. One is cotton, and we don't eat cotton. And basically, the cotton imports represent the loss of textile jobs in the United States.
Because which is to say, they import cotton, but what they really have done is imported the textile jobs.
That's right. They've imported the U.S. cotton industry and the textile jobs.
Mm-hmm. So we'll buy your cotton and we'll take all your textile jobs.
That's right.
Okay.
And so cotton is one. The second thing is soybeans, and they have increased their soybean imports dramatically in a steady fashion over the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for the most part, like to import soybeans, not soybean meal and soybean oil, because they want to establish a viable crush industry where they crush the soybeans, they do the extra processing, they get the labor benefits from the crush.
So you get
they
the value
to meal and oil, and then use that for their growing animal production industry. And they export a little extra. You know, they export some of the meal or oil products they don't want.
Well, as a longtime student of China, I was studying the Chinese language during the Great Cultural Revolution, and I always wondered, you know, what would happen to China were it to shed its walls and break out and become a member of the world community. And well, it has, and they are demonstrating themselves to be world-class capitalists when it gets right down to the deal. As we just talked about in cotton, they'll import cotton, but they'll also import your cotton industry. They'll import your soybeans, but they'll also import your soil industry. And so here you have a country of 1.3 billion people who is essentially feeding itself on an agriculture based on yesterday's technology, with some modern adaptations, of course. So we look at China now has most of our money, and how are they investing that money in natural resources? What is the how are they going out into the world and spending that money, Harwood?
I don't know how they're spending it in the rest of the world. I do know that inside China, they're making a tremendous investment in infrastructure. The research stations that we saw, the agricultural research stations, were world-class. I mean, they're doing world-class research. They've been able... They started with, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, with some very degraded soils, both in the North China Plain where we were and in Heilongjiang Province up in the soybean area. And they invested in basic agricultural research, gave their scientists the equipment that they needed to do their work, and have been able to bring about a tenfold increase in the production of once degraded lands.
Well, that 10 times nothing is still not much, though. How does that compare with the rest of the world, their productivity?
Well, the U.S. national corn yield, and this is in metric units, but the U.S. national corn yield is around 10 tons per hectare using metric units. In China, in the North China Plain, where they double crop wheat and corn, between the two crops, they get 15 tons per hectare.
Wow.
So that their output per unit of land is greater than they are in the United States. Their wheat yields are above U.S. yields. Their corn yields are slightly below, but it's double crop yields. It's not primary crop yields. It's not surprising that the corn yields are down a little bit in a double crop.
And that's one of the things that, F.H. King in his Farmers of 40 Centuries observed as he interviewed, you know, the Chinese farmer. It was truly amazing to him. Whereas we would grow one or two crops per year, the Chinese farmer was more likely to grow a number of crops every year and still somehow figure out how to sustain the soil so that it would continue to bear. What did they do between the Cultural Revolution and now to enable them to sustain those kinds of yields? Because if you're double cropping cropland, I mean, you're going to draw all the wealth out of that soil pretty quick unless you do something to put it back.
Well, in the North China Plain, much of the agriculture is no-till.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not taking... they're leaving some of the residue on the soil. They're not exposing the soil to wind and water erosion. So they no-till the corn. We saw them getting ready for the wheat harvest. As soon as the wheat harvest was done, they no-tilled corn into the wheat stubble. And then in the fall, when they harvested the corn, they would take some of the stalk and use it for fodder, and they would then no-till wheat right back into the corn stalks.
Mm-hmm. So in the great Chinese tradition, absolutely nothing goes to waste, correct?
Absolutely nothing appears to go to waste. You know, the poplar trees support a forest industry and sawmills and plants or small yards that made sheets, plies for plywood that later was laminated someplace else. They made local products out of it. They used some of the wood for making greenhouses that they would stretch plastic over. They used the slab wood for fences around their own. In the villages, everybody had a lot that was about 20 meters wide by about 60 or 80 meters long, and you'd have a house on the front, and then they would put a fence around that plot and put a backyard, a huge backyard garden in, and they would use the slab wood from the poplar trees to make the fence.
Hmm.
I mean, nothing went to waste.
Nothing went to waste. Well, folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We have Harwood Schaefer with us, Research Associate at the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center. When we get back, I have a question for Harwood, who is also a sociologist. I would like to ask Harwood what impact he sees the Cultural Revolution had on China's booming economy today. It seems like for many, many years, the government of China just completely suppressed its people, and now it seems to have let go a little bit, and those people are just thriving, and China now has an economy that is the center point of the world. It is the Middle Kingdom. And of course, we're open to questions and comments from you. The phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. China, what impact will this country's 1.3 billion person appetite have on our ability to eat food? Give us a ring. We will be right back. Well, sometimes we get really close to a subject and watch it, like a bee, perhaps, that flies from flower to flower. And sometimes we stand way back. We go up on top of a mountain and try to see over the horizon. And that's exactly what we're doing today. We're looking over the horizon, the Pacific Rim to be exact, and we're looking at the great country of China, the Middle Kingdom, Zhonghua. And we're trying to figure out what impact this country's $1.3 billion appetite will have on our food chain here in the United States, if it will have any at all. We have Harwood Schaefer with us, who is the Research Associate with the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, the University of Tennessee, and also a sociologist. And today I want to ask Harwood about the impact the Cultural Revolution might have on the Chinese work ethic and desire to move into the world. Folks, those of you who do not know about the Cultural Revolution and the impact it has had on China, is one of the truly amazing pieces of human history, where an entire nation went politically correct, I guess it were, and suffered deprivations unimaginable to you and I, who hold forth such notions as individual rights. Well, there were none in the Cultural Revolution. If you didn't toe the line, you were sent to the country to shovel manure, and your whole family was split up, and you lost everything in a matter of seconds. And it happened to millions and millions and millions and millions of people. And so it was a nation that was forced to go without just about everything, except fealty to the status quo. And someplace along the line, China reversed courses, and it became interested in becoming part of the world. And as a consequence of that change of course, it set up manufacturing facilities and developed the ability to make things cheaper, less expensive than anybody else in the world. And today, China is the world's greatest creditor nation, sitting on approximately $1 trillion of our cold, hard cash. And we, of course, have become the world's greatest debtor nation. And so that's the question, what impact is this going to have on our ability to eat? So I'd like to ask Harwood, if I might, what impact he believes, as a sociologist, that deprivation of the great Cultural Revolution had on China's psyche and its move forth into the world economy. Harwood?
Well, one of the things that, there are a couple of things. One is that during the Cultural Revolution, there really was famine and hunger. It really was a failed process, and it brought about both land degradation and it brought about massive hunger. And so one of the consequences of that is that China is really interested in remaining as self-sufficient as they can in terms of food. That is, they don't want to be dependent upon anyone else for feeding their population. They understand that feeding 1.3 billion people is job one. They're going to be much slower, I think, coming out into the world to really do major, to become
buyers.
Pardon?
To become buyers.
To become buyers and become dependent upon somebody else for feeding their population.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do it themselves.
Doesn't every country, when it gets right down to it, isn't that, you know, a core instinct of every nation's survival? Is that...
I believe it is, unless you're a city-state on a major trade route where you simply don't have the land. But, right. But short of that, I think that is a general desire of people everywhere. In China, it's magnified because their experience of famine and deprivation is so recent.
Wow.
And so it brings that message home directly to them.
So no fooling. We know exactly what the alternative means. So we're ready to go to work. It's kind of the national psych, right?
And we're ready to make the investment that it takes to do that,
mm-hmm.
And to support that agriculture and to make sure that agriculture. Is capable of feeding our population.
And they're doing that, of course, with our money.
I didn't see the money flow. One can assume that, but, you know, when you look at the kind of agriculture that the majority of the people are in, they certainly are not using our money to buy big machines.
Correct.
They're using... low input agriculture compared to what we have in the U.S. And beating us at the game. They're producing as well with their low input agriculture as we do with our high input agriculture.
So the farmers of 40 centuries that F.H. King wrote about at the turn of the last century is still thriving in China.
Yes.
They still know how to do this without spending a lot of money, buying a lot of equipment. And we seem to have taken the other course, and their agriculture seems to be sufficiently feeding 1.3 billion people. What happens, though, if they need to buy food from the rest of the world? They have the money.
If they were to need to buy it, they have the cash. The question is, without... any reserve, very few reserve stocks in the world. The question is, like in this year where you've got flooding in the Midwest and shortages, if they weren't producing their own corn in China, where are they going to buy it?
Right.
We may not have enough to sell, and they're smart enough to understand that floods like we're having in the U.S. and significantly reduced crops can take place.
Let me go back to that question again about to Harwood, the sociologist. Do you think the deprivation of the Cultural Revolution made the Chinese better capitalists, or were they always great capitalists, just unable to practice it? And I just think of this in terms of their world dealings. It seems like they always get the better side of the deal here. You know, you talk about the only thing they're buying from us. We buy everything from them, of course. It seems like you can't buy anything anymore that's not made in China. And the one thing that they buy from us, cotton, they bought from us because they imported our entire textile industry. So that's a heck of a deal. And similarly with soybeans, they buy soybeans from us, but in the process of doing that, they're importing our entire soybean industry. And so... I mean, I go back to this question of their wheeling and dealing in the world. Do you think the Cultural Revolution had an impact on their desire to really go out there and do business in the world?
I didn't hear any conversations there that would indicate that. They certainly are great marketers.
Right.
I would make a distinction between being a great marketer and being a great capitalist. They certainly are great marketers. Their ability to move their product.
Can we hold that? We have to take a quick break. But I'd like to go back to that and talk about their ability to market then. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Harwood Schaefer, Research Associate, Agricultural Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee, and you, 831-479-1980, 800-624-2665. Right back with Chung Gua. Well, think about this, folks. A 1.3 billion person appetite fed with a technology that's 40 centuries old. That's China, able to take care of itself without the modern technologies of made possible by petroleum, hydrocarbon energy, and equipment, machineries. Truly amazing when you think about it. And part of their abilities, as Harwood Schaefer tells us, is that they're great marketers. What do you mean by that, Harwood?
In terms of, I make the distinction between capitalists and marketers in terms of their goals. Capitalists have a different kind of goal and a privatization of wealth. They market, but the wealth is not necessarily privatized in the same way that the capitalist system does. And so while they adopt parts of our system, they still retain responsibility for the welfare of their people and making sure that, I mean, they have significantly been able to reduce hunger in China. We read that they have poverty in the rural area, and certainly people in the rural area don't have the fancy homes that we would look at as necessary. On the other hand, they are able to feed themselves. The malnutrition rate has been significantly reduced in China, and so it's a different goal in terms of how they do their the goal of their marketing, and where the benefits are distributed.
So, how are the benefits distributed? Do the farmers, for example, get some of the money to spend as they wish, or?
Well, we saw a couple of villages, and in they were very similar in structure. But the one village, for instance, had 1,700 people who were a member of the village, who were part of the village. Of those 1,700, 1,100 were workers, so the rest were either children or older, retired or unable to work. Of those 1,100 and some who were workers, and the numbers don't quite add up that we got, but they're close. About 365, 400 of them were farmers. About 400 of them worked, or 450 worked off-farm in some other kind of employment. And then another 150 were migrant workers. And when we ask a little bit more about the migrant workers, it turns out this was up in Heilongjiang province, and about 150 members of the village in the spring went north and crossed the river into the Russian Far East, and I would guess squatted on farm ground up there that wasn't being used and planted crops and then came back for the winter.
I saw that happen on the headwaters of the Amazon. People from the cities would go out as the rivers started to recede. They'd go out and plant crops along the banks of the Rio Ucayali, And as the waters receded, the crops would grow, and then they'd harvest, and then the rains would come, and they'd go back into town. Let's go quickly to Bill, who has a related question. Bill, welcome to the food chain. You've got Harwood Schaefer, and yours truly, Michael Olson. Fire away.
Yeah, I was wondering if the farmers pay any property tax on those farms.
Harwood?
Most they did at one time did have some levies. They're to start with the farm ground. That village, for instance, has 700 hectares, so each farmer's allocated a little less than 2 hectares. They're held in they're in a common field, and your hectares are so many rows wide by the depth, and no, they don't pay taxes the same way we do on the farm ground itself.
Bill?
Thanks. Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, thank you very much for that call. So we're getting this incredible productivity out of these very small parcels of land that are owned individually and then farmed communally. I guess communal is still a word in operation.
They're owned communally. That is, the community owns the land.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers are allocated and given so much, and they have what would be called usufruct rights. That is, they have the right to use the land. And as a new child is born, they're allocated. That family's then allocated some land for that child. If that child stays in agriculture, that child can grow crops on that and maintain a livelihood. If that child leaves and takes a job in the city, then those acres go back to the community and are distributed to the new children being born.
And that's the need for China to really get a rein in on its population then, correct? Because if
yes.
Yeah. Well, when we come back from this final break, I have one final question, which has been puzzling me for some time. And essentially, we talked a lot about how China can support itself on this technology that's based on 40 centuries. But my question is, what happens if it can't? And it has to go into the worldwide marketplace for food. And it has the cash to buy food. And what if we have to compete with China for food? How will that work? I'm going to ask Harwood Schaefer when we come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We're talking about China and what impact this country's 1.3 billion person appetite might have on our ability to eat food. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. So few minutes, so much to talk about. We have Harwood Schaefer here with us to talk today. He's a researcher. What are you doing? Oh, again. We have Harwood Schaefer, who is a research associate with the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee. And we're talking about China and what impact it will have on our ability to eat food. And one question that really sticks in my craw that I have to ask today is about China. For many years, it was locked up in its site itself, and today it is the focal point of the world's economy. It is the world's largest creditor nation, and we have become the world's largest debtor nation. China is sitting on $1 trillion of our cash, our cold hard cash, and every day we must borrow money from China in order to buy more things Chinese. So you look at this equation and you wonder what will happen if China's agriculture, which is based on a technology of 40 centuries, what happens if it is not able to satisfy the hunger of a 1.3 billion person appetite? What if China has to go into the international marketplace for food? How will we compete with China for that food? True, we do grow a lot of food here in the United States, but that food does not belong to us. It belongs to whoever grew it and whoever buys it on the open marketplace. So I guess my question is, if push comes to shove and China must go out into the international marketplace for food, how will we compete with it? Harwood, you're a a research associate at the University of Tennessee. You're a PhD candidate in sociology, and by golly, you're a pastor. And you're looking at this question, what kind of answer would you come up with?
Well, certainly, if they need it, they can go out into the market and they can buy it. I mean, they've got the cash in the bank, so there's no question they can do it. The question is in the short term, they're likely to go out and buy it, and they can basically outcompete anybody else because they've got the money. But in the longer term, the question is, will they buy food? Or we've seen a little bit of evidence that maybe what they would do is simply go to other nations that have available land and buy the land and produce on the land and ship it back home and basically guarantee that they can feed it because they own the land in the other country and they send the food back to to China.
And we're seeing this happening in Brazil, where they're buying up soybean land, correct?
It's hard to verify the reports, but there are indications at least that there is concern about buying in Brazil and buying in the Philippines. Philippines is much closer, and buying land that they can then produce corn on and ship that corn directly into China.
And they're also buying
a Chinese-owned firm.
I understand they're also buying the fertilizer resources and, of course, the petroleum. Wow. Folks, you've been tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've been talking with Harwood Schaefer, Research Associate with the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee, and you about the big country, China. I want you to stay tuned for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. See you all next week. Please, and thank you for joining us.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.